If I'm being honest, guys, you don't want me doing an ad read about having a smoothball bag, having food delivered to your house, or building a website online. But what you do want is more content, which can be found at the Murder Me Monday podcast Patreon in the link below. You get access a week early, exclusive content, and a shout out if you care about that kind of thing. Because I don't want to do ad reads. I don't want to do this. It would be horrific. Now, hopefully that's made Mother happy promoting the Patreon, and hopefully you enjoy the show. We'll see you around. Much love. Peace.
Spree killing is frighteningly more common than we have been told, yet it is not a new phenomenon. What drives people to do it? Personality disorders or a hatred for everyone, including themselves? Perhaps there are life stressors that tip someone over the edge from rational thought to homicidal rage. Or are there sometimes physical reasons that maybe change someone's personality until they could no longer keep the darkness at bay? These are the cases of Andrew Kehoe and the Bath School disaster, and Charles Whitman and the Texas Tower shooting. And this is Murder Me on Monday.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Murder Me Monday podcast. I'm Cameron, and joined with me is Mother.
Hello.
This feels slightly topical in terms of school shootings, which is a slightly odd thing to be doing for me. Even though it's not in bad taste, because if it was, then people reporting on the news would be bad taste, so it's not that. But I am also worried in case I say something funky, because I will, because it's me.
Yes.
So I'm going to be on good behavior, because it's a bit of a sensitive topic.
Yes, definitely. This is why these are historical ones I wanted to do.
It's a bit more removed from the most recent one.
And I didn't want to do the ones that everybody else has heard of.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So we in the UK have only ever had one incidence of such an act. And people are still traumatised by the Dunblane massacre.
Is that with the shotgun?
No. I know the one you're thinking of, but no. That's the Hungerford massacre you're thinking of.
Okay. I know very briefly, or very loosely, on what the UK have in terms of mass shootings, because we don't have them.
No. And this
almost as if gun control and regulation works, isn't it? It's funny that. It's weird.
Well, this specifically is the only school one we've ever had. It took place at Dunblane Primary School near Stirling in Scotland on the 13th of March 1996, when Thomas Hamilton shot dead 16 pupils and one teacher and injured 15 others before killing himself. It remains the deadliest mass shooting in British history, and two new firearms acts were passed to outlaw private ownership of most handguns in the UK. The tennis player and former number one, Andy Murray, and his brother Jamie were in the school when the massacre took place.
Really?
Yeah.
It was that recent?
Yeah.
How old's Andy Murray? I mean, however old he must be to be at the school at the time. I didn't know that.
Yeah. They also knew Hamilton, sometimes sharing a car. They gave him lifts to the station and stuff like that. And they attended kids' clubs that he ran. I believe Andy has only ever spoken out about this once or twice in the press. And it's got to, from time to time, make you think and wonder what might have been, doesn't it? We also often see in the press in the UK about school stabbings in China, where it's usually described as a mentally ill or disgruntled man, hates his job, wife, authorities, insert grievance here sort of thing, who goes into a primary school and stabs and kills children. Very little is revealed, and justice is swift out there, and they are often summarily executed after a show trial of only a few hours. What their figures are, we will probably never know. It's not something they want to publicise, is it? But it's not a new phenomenon for people to attack children at a school.
A society where you have regular mass shootings, spree killings, or school shootings is not a healthy society, regardless of how you try to frame it. You can't have a catch-all of it's a mental health issue and then do zero to help people with mental health issues, or create a society where it's easy to access help.
I completely agree with you.
So therefore, we need to create regulation on the other thing. You've got regulations for cars. People try to say a car can kill people, so you've got to regulate cars. We do. You have to driving tests, DMVs, you have social security, national insurance numbers, all these things to regulate it. Why not have the same thing for guns? You can get your guns, but there needs to be a database for it and remove private selling.
Some of the different states, I believe, are enacting something very similar to that, but it's state by state. That's the problem.
And that's why it's relevant. That's why when Chicago bans guns, they can just drive for 20 minutes, go across state borders, buy a gun, come back. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I know. The weaponry has somewhat changed, but we're going to cover these two historic cases. The first one I found by accident, and the second one I knew of, but wondered if the old rumours I read about 40 years ago had been confirmed or debunked. Let us go to Bath Township, small rural community of about 300 people, not far from Lansing in Michigan, back in time to the 18th of May, 1926. The school had been built in 1922, and at the time of the incident, it had 314 pupils. Many were the sons and daughters of other local farmers, and a huge amount were bused to school as it covered a large catchment area. Now, this school had to be paid for, and of course, local taxes would have been the way. One local chap didn't think it was fair he should pay. After all, it didn't benefit him, did it?
Everyone can see the flaw with that logic, right? If you don't use that very specific thing that your tax pays towards, then, I'm not paying for it then. You can see why the thing of living in a society is you pay for these things, these social safety nets. If you don't pay for kids to go to school, and then you wonder, my area is going to shit because you've got uneducated people not doing anything.
I completely agree.
Might be as if you had more educated people going to school, then less bad things are going to happen. This guy's not particularly clever, is he?
Well, he's going to wind you up because he actually is. He lived with his wife, Nellie, on a farm. Michigan State graduate with a degree in electrical engineering. He became a farmer, and according to a lot of reports, he wasn't much of a one.
Farming is massively subsidized by the government anyway.
Now, we're talking 1926.
Even back then, it probably was. Either that is hyper-profitable, or it wasn't, in which case, why is he doing it? Like, or he's getting subsidized in some sort of way. If that's the case, fuck you, I don't buy vegetables, you don't get the tax from that. What's his name?
Andrew Kehoe.
You'd suck my dick, Andrew. No.
Well, you're probably not wrong, because the farm was considered to be one of the best in the area. Yet he was going to lose it. He'd stopped paying the mortgage. He stopped paying his taxes. And then what would have gotten him out of a financial hole, he didn't even harvest his crops in the autumn of 1925. All his neighbours are like, what's wrong with this guy?
Is he some kind of, he's dead. Was he some kind of libertarian taxationist theft person? Probably, if he didn't want to pay taxes for
probably.
His
so that,
schools.
That farm, there's a lot of different sizes, but I've got mainly 80 acres. And it had, at that time, an assessed value of $10,000. It's about $150,000 in today's money. His school tax bill was $198,000, which is equivalent to just over $3,000 today's dollar. Andrew Philip Kehoe was born in Michigan on February the 1st, 1872, into a family of 13 children and attended a local high school. His mother died when he was young. He then studied electrical engineering at Michigan State College in East Lansing and moved to St. Louis, where he worked as an electrician for several years.
Are we ignoring the whole cognitive dissonance thing of him going to schools and shit? And people that wouldn't have had kids are probably also paying into those schools, etc., etc. And again, with 13, 12 other siblings, whatever, because his parents are shaggers, that would have been in the 1800s, which is when they would have been. Of course, stuff would have been paid by tax. So he himself has directly benefited from tax, providing social safety net type things, okay? Fucking,
Yeah, you're going to get wound up with this one, aren't you?
It's cognitive dissonance really annoys me.
I wonder where that university education, where that funding for that came from, because I doubt very much whether his parents would have paid for it. And I don't know in the 1920s whether it was...
It would have cost about £3.50. to pay for uni back then. So it wouldn't matter. You could have worked for 6 weeks at a co-op and paid for it. I would say at a bodega, but he was probably racist, so he wouldn't have wanted to work at a bodega. Do you know what I mean? Back then, it's so much easier.
Well, he's working as this electrical engineer, but at some point during this period, he suffered a head injury in a fall and was either semi-conscious or in a coma for a period of several weeks. So he leaves St. Louis, goes back to Michigan and his father's farm. So he's been brought up in a farming community. He knows how to farm.
Has there been reports of huge behavioural changes when he got clapped upside the head?
No. But going back to this time, people wouldn't have recorded this.
They wouldn't have known what CTE is.
No, exactly.
Did I tell you about the time I thought a knock on the head that I got as a kid that I may have not told you about?
Oh, God.
If I haven't mentioned it on the podcast, I'm sure I told you before. We were in Turkey once on holiday, and I was fucking about on this banister thing, and below that was a restaurant. I was climbing around the banister, leaning off it, and the banister fell off, and I fell about 12 foot onto my ass, and then the banister fell on top of my head.
This is the first I'm hearing about this.
Now I can do the alphabet backwards. But, if you drop toothpicks, I'll count them. I'll be wrong because I'm thick. And the guy that was with at the time, this other kid I was playing with, he said, right, he asked me really simple, basic math questions and I got them right. He's like, yeah, you're fine, I've got a concussion. It was that fucking 9 years old as well. I was like, you didn't notice anything. You didn't notice my eyes were wonky or I was limping. So you did. Obviously, it didn't do anything, hopefully.
I'm absolutely horrified. This is the first I'm hearing of this.
It's an exclusive, yeah.
Good Lord. Well, yeah.
We're talking about brain trauma. I had some, I guess.
Going back to the case.
So we're just brushing off my head trauma. Okay, carry on.
You were nine, you think?
Tell me about his mother.
No, I'm curious now. Which resort was it in? Do you remember?
It might have even been Mallorca, actually. Might not have even been Turkey.
Oh, so I wasn't in Mallorca, was I?
You were.
No, we went to Menorca.
It's the same thing. I don't care.
We've got to argue over that one now.
Anyway, get back to the case.
Right. After his mother's death, Andrew's father, Philip, had married a much younger widow by the name of Frances. On September the 17th, 1911, Frances attempted to light the family's oil stove. It exploded and set her on fire. Andrew, whom I would like to point out was actually 39 when he did this, not 14 as in some other accounts, threw a bucket of water on her. But his action obviously spread the flames more rapidly because it's oil-based.
When water evaporates, it expands 4,000 times.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's why if you have an oil fire, you should never, or a fire on a pan, you should never chuck oil in it because it evaporates.
Water.
Yeah, water evaporates and goes into the air and it expands 4,000 times and it's enough and the fire can then ignite that.
Yeah.
And that's where it goes, woof, and it goes up much more. And he did that to her, basically, down into like a little fire plume.
Well, she went up like a Roman candle, poor thing. She died the next day. There was a lot of speculations from neighbours that Andrew knew something that was wrong with that stove, or maybe he perhaps caused it.
And this is his...
Stepmother. Yeah, he's 39 years old. He's an electrical engineer, and his stepmother gets covered in oil when the stove blows up, so he throws water on her.
Back then, he might have even been taught that. Because for electrical fires, you'd be taught how to do very basic fire safety. You get taught... I got taught this in college between the fire extinguishers you use. If it's a solids fire or a gas fire or an oil fire, you have to use different fire extinguishers if there's like foam, CO2 or water.
Yeah, I'm just suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, he might have been taught very basic safety, so he would have known what not to use. If there's an oil fire and he's chucked water on it, it could be...
It was supposed to be, wasn't it, a damp dishcloth over the top?
I think it's actually CO2 is what you use
now. Yeah, now.
But you engulf it probably, you cover him.
I mean, you hear about drop to the ground and roll, don't you? So Andrew eventually married Nellie in 1912 at the age of 40. He had known her since high school. Things really started to go wrong when Nellie became ill. And it was an illness that was similar to TB, may have even been TB, tuberculosis. But back then there was no treatment. So she was in and out of hospital. And when he was notified in June of 1925, so almost a year earlier, that his farm was going to be foreclosed on, that mortgage was owned by a relative of his wife. So that must have burnt. His behaviour becomes weird even to his neighbours because, say, this farm was going to be taken away from him. Apparently, he started to cut fences down, poison and cut down plants, etc. It's described as vines, so I'm assuming fruit vines. It may have been grapes, I don't know, but he cut through the bottom of the vine and then stuck it back on, so it looked like it was still there and alive, but he'd effectively killed them. He also killed his neighbor's dog and beat one of his horses to death, so I instantly disliked him the moment I read that one.
Was it his horse or his neighbor's horse?
No, one of his own horses. He doesn't get better with his animal cruelty anyway. 16th of May, 1927, Nellie's been released from hospital and goes home. At approximately 8:45 a.m. on Wednesday, the 18th of May, the house and farm buildings blew up. All the neighbours notice and rush over to the scene to help. Neighbours crawl through broken windows of the farmhouse in search of survivors. When they found no one in a house, they salvaged what furniture they could before the fire spread further throughout the house. One man discovered dynamite in the corner of a room. He picked up an armful of the explosives and handed it off to another man to get it out of the house. So all these nice neighbours are rushing about trying to help when they notice Andrew sat in his truck. He tells them they should get to the school and then drove off. So all these neighbours are rushing about wondering what the heck when they finally find Nellie, dead in a wheelbarrow at the rear of the farm's chicken coop. When she was found...
Why did you pause? Do you think I was going to say something?
Yes, I did.
No.
When she was found, she was in she was charred. After the farm explosion and fire, Andrew had actually killed her at some point after she'd gotten home from the hospital 2 days earlier. We don't know. There was a 2-day gap between her getting home and then her body being found. So piled around the wheelbarrow was silverware. So, you know, the things like teapots and stuff like that made of silver and a metal cash box. The ashes of several banknotes could be seen through the slit in the top of the cash box, an old-fashioned cash box.
This is what surrounded her?
Yes. It was in the wheelbarrow with her.
With her?
Yes.
Just expensive shit and money?
Yes. Yes.
This sounds like a ritual to something, doesn't it? Why would you do that?
Actually, no, you've said that.
Yeah. I don't know why you would. Why else would you put... I wouldn't club someone's head in and chuck a telly on them. I don't know. Or like my PlayStation. I don't see why you do that.
No, but... Again, who knows what's going through his head, why he's doing any of these things, apart from the fact he's pissed off about the taxes.
If he's pissed off about losing money, then wouldn't sacrifice more money? That's what I don't
understand. You would have thought, yeah. So Andrew had placed and wired homemade pyrotol firebombs in the house and throughout the farm buildings. He'd also hobbled his horses with barbed wire so they couldn't move and set the stable on fire as well. Why mention the school when he drove off? Andrew had somehow or another got himself elected to the position of treasurer on the Bath School Board. He'd actually served as a town clerk before, but lost the next election, which pissed him off. He would argue frequently with the school superintendent and other board members about the cost of the school, objecting to every dollar spent on essential stuff and wanted his taxes reduced.
But what's the alternative, though? You give kids a shitty school. Why would you want that? Okay, even if you don't want your taxes being spent on it, why would you want the kids to suffer? Okay, you can argue that the money isn't being spent in the best way, that can cause a problem, and then you might want an itinerary of what's being spent. But fundamentally, you want the kids to have the best chance to succeed. I know I'm approaching it... I was going to make a joke about me being hit on the head again there, but that's a good... If I can still see the reason why you'd want that, why
you
can't he?
You are approaching that as a fully conscious member of society. He isn't. He only cares about himself. He doesn't give... a rat's ass about anybody. He never won any of the battles with the school board. They just carried on buying what they needed to buy. Andrew had been that electrician. He'd also worked in the school, so it probably gave him knowledge of the layout over and above that which anyone else may have had. You know, the crawl spaces between floors and various openings that you wouldn't normally have known about. Andrew also had a large supply of explosives. World War I surplus. He bought them direct from the government. They used them to help farmers remove tree stumps, all perfectly legal at the time. You go off and buy dynamite, you had a tree stump in the middle of your field, you'd blow it up. All completely legit. It's horrifying when you think about it.
I'd want to do it, but it's quite scary to think a member of the public can have a dynamite they can blow up.
Andrew had rigged the school and his truck with these homemade bombs and explosives. And as he hated that school above all else, and the taxes were the reason he was losing his farm, in his mind. Classes began at the school at 8:30 a.m. Andrew had set an alarm clock in the basement of the north wing of the school, which detonated the dynamite and the pyrotol that he'd hidden there at about 8:45 a.m. So the school... kids go in at 8:30, he blows the school, or supposed to blow it up, at 8:45. Rescuers heading to the scene of his farm fire heard the explosion at the school and turned back in that direction. The school building resembled a war zone. 38 people killed in the initial explosion, mostly children.
That sounds exactly what terrorists do.
Yes.
Their explosions, they set off a mini explosion, make everyone run the opposite direction, and they set off their big explosion.
Yeah. But the weird thing was, he was sat at the farm when his farm blew up, and he was watching them in his truck. And then when he drove off, and he said, they had no idea what on earth he was talking about. So they're running about, and obviously they find Nelly. And he'd set this bomb at the school up with a timer to go off 15 minutes after the kids went in. But he isn't there at that point. Andrew drove up to the school about 9:15. He saw the superintendent and summoned him over to his truck. You know, come here. An eyewitness later said that he saw the two men grappling over some type of long gun before the truck also exploded. Andrew had detonated another bomb, killing himself, the superintendent, and another farmer who was nearby who was helping with the aftermath of the school bomb. The explosion also killed an 8-year-old second grader who'd survived the first blast, wandered out the school building, and he was killed by a fragmentation from the truck blowing up. So the poor little thing's gone out, you know, wondering what on earth hit him, and he, yeah. That truck explosion spread debris over a large area and caused extensive damage to cars parked half a block away, with their roofs catching on fire from the burning petrol. It injured several others and wounded another man who lost a leg and died before actually making it to hospital. Hundreds of people come to help from miles around, and a search and rescue operation was started. Searching the school, they found an additional 500 pounds or 230 kilograms of dynamite which had failed to detonate in the south wing. The search was halted to allow the Michigan State Police to disarm the devices, and they found an alarm clock again set to go off at 8:45. So you've got north wing and the south wing of the school, and he set timers for both of them to go up the same time. The investigators speculated that the initial explosion may have caused a short circuit in the second set of bombs, preventing them from detonating. He had actually hidden 900 pounds of dynamite between the basement ceiling and the main floor.
How did he get 900 pounds? I know why, because he's a farmer, so he buys all the World War One surplus. Is there not a limit on how much dynamite one single farmer could need? What is he blowing up? T-Rexes? You don't need that much dynamite.
What record keeping would there have been back in 1920?
Fucking still should have been.
I mean, the fact that he had a pile of it in his living room and one of the other blokes picked it up, took it out, gave it to somebody else before that.
£900.
£900. And he managed to sneak it all in. The investigators estimate that the May explosion involved about £200, and the other £700 was actually found later, wired to timers to set off go, so the whole school was going to explode. They also recovered a container of gasoline in the school's basement, petrol. The container was rigged with a tube, and it was speculated that Andrew had planned that the petrol fumes would ignite from a spark, scattering burning petrol throughout the basement. So he was going to get everybody, wasn't he? Investigators also found a wooden sign wired to Andrew's farm entrance with his last message on it. Criminals are made, not born. It's called a disaster, but it's cold-blooded murder. And to this day, it's still the worst school massacre in American history, killing as many as the Sandy Hook and Parkland shootings combined.
I think this one that happened most recently, the one in Uvalde, Texas, is said to be the second worst one. And the Sandy Hook one is the first, I think, might be the other way around. I think it's because this isn't defined as a shooting.
No, so that's exactly.
So it's slightly different. It's going off of different records.
That's why I fell over it and I'd never heard of it.
I think so, because it's so long ago.
Yeah.
1926, they probably thought, that's not good farmers, so much dynamite.
Mm-hmm. So the school was demolished and a new school opened in its place in 1928. That school was torn down in 1975 and a commemorative park was created on the site, which is, I think, the right thing to do. I can understand why they rebuilt the school, but it would leave everybody in the surrounding areas really...
So that's it then? He was blown up? There's no sort of conclusion, I guess, apart from that? There was no manifesto?
No.
There was no other sort of investigation as to reasons why anything that came from that? Did anything change in terms of laws, regulations on...
I'm assuming something about blooming dynamite. After what? Yeah. But the only thing was that notice on the gate from the farm.
Did anything happen to... And when he says the criminals are made, not born, if him traumatising... It'd be thousands of people would be traumatised by those events. You're just going to make more criminals? I don't get it. Obviously, he's had some kind of mental break or has permanently been mentally broken. Hits on the head probably didn't help. I can relate.
Yeah, there is... It was so long ago. That's the problem. They did a lot of investigation into the actual bombings and they did talk to a lot of the neighbours. And most just said he was weird and got weirder over time because apparently he was a bit of a tinkerer, obviously being an electrical engineer. He was more interested in getting the latest bit of farm equipment and then tinkering with it to try and make it better than actually using the bloody equipment out on the farm and making the farm profitable.
Yeah. It's I can understand the rationale between getting hold of it and wanting to play with it and wanting to tinker with it. But then why wouldn't you then replace the thing that you'd used before and then so you have the old one, play with that one.
Yeah.
So you can, if that breaks, your thing for like plowing the fields isn't fucked.
Oh, and one other thing. You remember I said that the taxes for the school for that year would equate to about $3,000. He complained at some point because, say, this relative of his wife had called in the mortgage because he'd stopped paying it. So they're saying, right, we're going to foreclose on you and you've got to leave. He turned round to neighbours and said, because he had no friends, that $3,000 or the, you know, $198 that it actually was, if he hadn't had to pay that in taxes for the school, it would have paid off the mortgage on that farm and that farm and him would have been free and clear. But if he got his flipping head out from underneath the latest tractor and actually farmed it, he could have made it. Because he didn't even bring his crops in from the year before.
It's a poor argument to say that to pay off the entirety of the mortgage could be done with 1 year's worth of tax. And then 1 year's worth of tax is only a small percentage of your total income. That means your total income could have paid everything off.
Yes. You're absolutely right.
So I don't understand. Obviously, there is no logic to his logic, but I don't understand it.
No. But you can't argue with people like that, can you? Because they
are. And you can't argue with him because he's dead. But you can't argue with him when he's mental.
Yeah, he's fixed. He's mentally fixed.
What's the saying? Playing chess with a pigeon? That's not quite all the pieces and shit's on the chessboard, so there's no point trying.
I've never heard that
but
one.
You get what I mean?
I get exactly what... I've now visioning... Oh.
You don't argue with stupid people because they'll drag you down to their level and they've got more experience. Yeah.
You can't argue with stupid people. You just will never get anywhere. You're just constantly going round and round in circles.
So that's the conclusion of the first one then?
Yeah. So on to our second case. Unfortunately, it's been brought back up because of the recent case and it also took place in Texas. Charles Joseph Whitman was born the 24th of June, 1941, in Lake Worth, Florida. He was the eldest of three boys. His parents got married when his mother was only 17, and her marriage was not a happy one. Pa Whitman was said to be authoritarian and violent, physically and emotionally abusive to his wife and his children.
So his dad's a little Nazi, basically. Yeah. Yep.
Despite all of that, apparently Charles showed huge promise. No idea why, but at the age of 6, his IQ was tested and shown to be about 139, which is almost genius level, isn't it? Now, what was it you said to me the other day?
The IQ scores skew towards young. They will skew to be of a young age. If you're a child and you score highly, the stats get kind of inflated arbitrarily because an intelligent child might be the top 99% intelligence of a child, but they're still going to be thick compared to someone that might have had some form of education. They're a child. Yeah. You don't expect them to have any kind of... And that's not saying the child's fucking stupid. It's just compared to Gen Pop, they might be less intelligent.
So
the figures always get skewed kind of high. It's like if someone's really heavy, they're going to be really strong for the most part in terms of the gym. So those their numbers are going to skew really high. Mm. Versus someone that's really light, they're going to lift proportionally much less. I know that might seem like a weird analogy, but they always skew really weird. It's like when people say, oh, my four-month-year-old child said water. They said agua. They said it in Spanish. Look, they're 4 months old and they're talking. It's a child. It blew a raspberry. It's not the same thing. So if a kid gets a huge IQ score, it doesn't mean they're smarter than Einstein.
Right. That makes complete sense.
No, I know that sounds like a weird tangent ramble thing, but you get what I mean.
Charles joined the Boy Scouts and he became the youngest Eagle Scout at 12 years old and 3 months. He also became an accomplished piano player at age 12. He started a paper round, was very devout, going to church with his mother every Sunday. Paul Whitman also taught him how to shoot, and again, he appeared to excel at that too. By the age of 14, he'd saved enough money from his newspaper round to purchase a Harley Davidson, which he used on his route to do the newspapers. 14 years old, back then they were allowed to ride motorbikes. He graduated high school and he enlisted in the USA Marine Corps, and he does well.
Oh, fuck, right. On the crib notes, it says a former Marine student, or a former Marine is a student. I read it as he was a Marine biologist.
Oh.
For some reason.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's completely changed what I thought the case was going to be. Carry on.
Well, he does well in the Marine Corps, and he applies for a scholarship to the Naval Enlisted Science and Education Program, NESEP, NESEP, which was an initiative designed to send enlisted personnel to college to train as engineers, and then after graduation, be commissioned as officers. So it was a really, you know, fast-moving, upward track type trajectory, wasn't it?
If you can pass the college degree type thing, it makes sense. If someone's highly educated and they're in the system, why wouldn't you want them to be elevated?
Yeah. So Charles, he passed all the entry requirements and he was approved to go to the University of Texas at Austin to study mechanical engineering. Then things started to go wrong. He's 20 years old and studying at this university, but his hobbies seem to be a bit more important than getting the good grades, and he's described as a poor student. His hobbies at the time included karate, scuba diving, gambling, and hunting. Charles and two friends were seen poaching a deer, with a passerby recording his license plate number and then reported them to the police. The trio were butchering the deer in the shower at Charles's dorm when they were arrested. Charles was fined $100, which was about $900 roughly for today's money, for that offence. Things went a little better when in February 1962 he meets Kathleen Leisner. She was an education major 2 years his junior. They dated for 5 months before announcing their engagement on the 19th of July. Then on the 17th of August 1962, they got married. Wasn't what's called a shotgun wedding, but those fast relationships make me nervous, especially as she was his first really serious relationship and only his second actual girlfriend. Seemingly, both families were very happy for them, and they all attended the wedding in Needville, which in Texas, which was Kathleen's hometown. Charles sort of got his act together, and his grades improved somewhat during his second and third semester. But the Marines considered them insufficient for continuation of his scholarship. He was ordered to return to active duty in February 1963 and went to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina for the remainder of his 5-year enlistment. So when he signed up, you know, you have to sign up for a period of time. Predictably, he got into trouble again, while also showing strange flashes of heroism. He was hospitalised for 4 days after single-handedly freeing another Marine by lifting a Jeep which had rolled over on an embankment. And this guy had got stuck underneath it and he just hoiked it off. The trouble part was his gambling. And eventually he was court-martialed. And he somehow managed to get an honourable discharge from the Marines. And he promptly rejoined the university program in Texas where he'd been kicked off. And his wife had stayed there while he was stationed in North Carolina because she's from Texas. You can't blame her. He was still financially dependent on his father, but he had that strong work ethic as demonstrated by that paper round as a child. He worked as what's called a bill collector for the Standard Finance Company. So I'm assuming you're going around saying you owe us £2.50 for, or, you know, $1.50 for whatever, give me the money. Then as a cashier at the Austin National Bank. In January 1965, he took a job as a traffic surveyor for the Texas Highway Department, while his wife worked as a biology teacher at a high school. He was also a volunteer scout leader with the Austin Scout Troop. May 1966 seems to be the start of the downward spiral. His mother and father get divorced. His mother moves to live with Charles and Kathleen and brings the youngest son with her, so Charles's younger brother. She gets the job and she eventually moves out. But the father called on the phone a lot, was trying to persuade her to come back to him. And he used to get hold of Charles and tell him that he needed to convince her that this was the right move. She had to come home. That was a lot of stress. Charles started abusing amphetamines and getting headaches. And it's hardly surprising, is it? He did try and get help, though. He had seen a minimum of 5 doctors during the autumn-winter period of 1965 before he visited a psychiatrist and then saw another psychiatrist who prescribed Valium and recommended that he visit the campus psychiatrist.
When he says abusing amphetamines, do you mean as in street amphetamines? Yes. Or pharma?
No. Street.
Pills, like Adderall, etc.
No, street.
Okay, so he's taking meth, basically.
Well, it's 1965. What was the equivalent?
I assume it's still methamphetamine. I don't actually know, but if he's abusing that, I assume it's that.
31st of July, 1966. Charles buys a pair of binoculars and a knife from a hardware store and some Spam from a 7-Eleven. Yes, Cameron is looking at me like, what the hell?
As in the food, Spam?
Yes.
As in like the weird cow's anus meat thing?
Yes.
Okay.
And I have no explanation, I'm going to tell you now because I'm not keeping it till the end, why that was reported,
yeah, so he bought,
what the significance is.
So he
is.
Bought some binoculars and some food, some weird canned meat.
Yes.
Okay, sure.
At about 4 p.m. on the 31st of July, Charles and his wife visited some friends and they left their apartment about just before 6 o'clock. So Kathy could get to her. She was doing a shift of 6 till 10, working as a telephone operator as a summer's job. School teacher, summer off, probably not getting paid back then. I get it. Just after midnight on August the 1st, Charles drove to his mother's apartment and killed her by stabbing her in the heart. He placed her body on her bed and covered it with sheets. No idea where his younger brother is. He left a handwritten note beside her body, which read in part, "To whom it may concern, I have just taken my mother's life. I am very upset over having done it. However, I feel that if there is a heaven, she is definitely there. I am truly sorry. Let there be no doubt in your mind that I loved this woman with all my heart." Charles then went home, where he killed Kathleen, his wife, by stabbing her 5 times in the chest as she slept. Covered her body with the sheets, same as his mother. He then goes back to a typewritten note he had started composing the previous evening. It's a suicide note. Some of it goes, "I do not quite understand what it is that compels me to type this letter. Perhaps it is to leave some vague reason for the actions I have recently performed. I do not really understand myself these days. I am supposed to be an average, reasonable and intelligent young man. However, lately, I cannot recall when it started, I have been the victim of many unusual and irrational thoughts. These thoughts constantly recur, and it requires a tremendous mental effort to concentrate on useful and progressive tasks." He goes on to ask in the note that an autopsy be performed on his remains after he was dead, to determine if there had been any discernible biological contributory cause for his actions and for his continuing and increasingly intense headaches. He also wrote that he had decided to kill both his mother and his wife, and he wanted to relieve both of them of the suffering of this world and to save them the embarrassment of his actions. A lot of it is couched in semi-religious phrasing too. Remember, he's a very devout Catholic. At 5:45 a.m, and that's flipping early, he rings his wife's job and says that she is sick and won't be in. He then does the same for his mother's job at 10:45 a.m. So what's he doing in those 5 hours between those calls? We don't know. At approximately 11:35 a.m, Charles goes to the university campus. He identified himself as a research assistant, which he wasn't, and told security guards that he was there to deliver equipment. He then climbed to the 28th floor of the main building's tower, clock tower. He killed 3 people within the tower and opened fire from the observation deck with a hunting rifle and various other weaponry. Altogether, Charles killed 14 people and wounded 31 in the 96 minutes before he was shot and killed by two officers of the Austin Police Department. One of those killed was an unborn child, and another person injured later died in 2001 from lifelong effects of the shooting. In total, 17 people died due to Charles Whitman's actions that day.
This is very different than the first one. He's self-aware. He's aware that there's something wrong with him that's altering his thoughts. He says, "I think something's funky. Look at my head when I'm dead." He killed his wife and his mother almost out of empathy.
Yeah.
Obviously, we don't agree with it, but it's out of empathy. It was the first one, he's killed them because he hated them and he pissed off about taxes. Grr. But this one, he wants to save them from something.
It's in his head, it's almost like a mercy killing, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not done out of malice. The outcome is the same as, unfortunately, someone gets murdered. But for him, it's to save them.
Yes, but why then go and kill these other people? We don't understand.
Because unfortunately, he's unwell. So for him, he's drawn the disconnect of maybe these people do need to die, and that's what's going on in his head, but he wants to save his mother and the mother and wife from that. Or if he thinks something bad's going to happen, and that's why he's done it as well. And maybe that tends to happen with it, but they think they're privy to information of some bad event going to happen.
Mm. You're not wrong. And I think what I'm going to go into next will kind of explain some of where you're coming from with that. So remember I said that psychiatrist recommendation to visit the campus psychiatrist? Well, he did visit him. And if it happened now, that psychiatrist would have been required by law to report what had been said. But back then he wasn't.
I think it's called a safeguarding referral.
Mm. So he saw this guy on the 29th of March 1966. He referred to his visit in his final suicide note, saying, "I talked with a doctor once for about 2 hours and tried to convey to him my fears that I felt overwhelming violent impulses. After one visit, I never saw the doctor again, and since then I've been fighting my mental turmoil alone and seemingly to no avail." The doctor's note said, "This massive, muscular youth seems to be oozing with hostility, that something seemed to be happening to him and he didn't seem to be himself."
That was oddly homoerotic.
It was a bit weird, wasn't it?
It's a very large, hunky, attractive man. Oozing. What? This is a bit weird.
He goes on, this psychiatrist, in his notes, he says, "He readily admits having overwhelming periods of hostility with a very minimum of provocation. Repeated inquiries attempting to analyze his exact experiences were not too successful, with the exception of his vivid reference to thinking about going up to the clock tower with a deer rifle and start shooting people." So although Charles had been prescribed drugs and was in possession of dexedrine, don't know what that was, at the time of his death, the toxicology was delayed because he'd been embalmed, but an autopsy had been requested on that suicide note, and it was then had to be approved by his father, and he did. On August the 2nd, an autopsy was conducted by a neuropathologist at Austin State Hospital at the funeral home, and they discovered what was described as a pecan-sized brain tumour, which was labelled as an astrocytoma, and which exhibited a small amount of necrosis. Obviously, there's a big investigation to this case, and a commission was, you know, brought together, and there were reports. That finding in the autopsy was subsequently overturned, and that tumour apparently had features of a glioblastoma multiforme with widespread areas of necrosis. And it had what was described as a remarkable vascular component. And I've just got horrible pulsating images from that one. Forensic investigators have theorised that that tumour pressed against Charles's amygdala.
Amygdala.
That's one. I can't pronounce that one either. So it's a part of the brain related to anxiety and the fight or flight responses. Although experts to this day still disagree on the tumour having caused that behaviour. And that was the bit I wondered about, because when I first read the case many years ago, it was dismissed as being a cause in the article that I actually read.
That might be the thing that controls the lizard brain. We've heard of that phrase before. I'm not sure if that's just considered antiquated science now, or a way to try to make an analogy for people to understand. I think that might be that. I'm also getting that and the corpus callosum and my brain confused, so I don't actually know which one's which. Part of the brain.
I know we still talk about lizard brain, don't we?
But again, I'm not sure if that's just a way of saying it so that people understand it.
Right, okay.
In like a colloquial use. That's your lizard brain, it's your primate brain, something you don't control. The fight or flight response, you don't sort of dictate that, do you?
Yes.
It's the panic. Do you run at the thing to stop the thing as dangerous, or just leg it?
Yeah.
And that might be what it is. I'm not sure. But I guess if the lizard brain, maybe that's something that controls part of the aggression, which would tie in with his.
So it's one of those cases, that one. When you look at it, people have obviously already started looking up pictures of them. I couldn't find any pictures of Andrew, actually, but... with Charles, he does, when you see the pictures of him, he looks, we kind of discussed this, he looks like a clean-cut, all-American, all-round good boy.
For all intents and purposes, he was. He was in the Marines, he started going to uni, and then some things fell, he went slightly downturn of luck, and he started having these other odd jobs here and there. And then somehow it evolved into this. It was, by all accounts, he should have had a pretty good upward trajectory.
I would have hoped so, but there were some other bits and pieces that came out when reading about it that I was still not too sure he would have turned out to be a good guy. He did admit to his friends, because his mother and father's relationship was really bad. There was physical abuse and there was emotional abuse. And he admitted to his friends that he'd slapped his wife a couple of times. And he said, I don't want to turn into my father. But he didn't seem to think that belting his wife a couple of times was a bad thing. But we are talking in the 1940s, aren't we?
He's a victim of the time.
Yeah.
And he's aware, at least. He's aware that slapping is a bad thing. And in his eyes, slapping would be different than what his dad did, which is a chronic series of abuse.
Yeah.
Which if he can rationalise that and see that as different, that's kind of... it's a bad thing he's hit it, but it's a good thing he's realised.
I just think if we'd have had modern... they had had the... access to modern medicine, and he would have been sent for a brain scan, an MRI, or the other one.
Did he any see in the active duty? Sorry,
no.
So you couldn't really claim PTSD from the duty. It could be PTSD from his dad.
Yeah, could be a whole rake of.
I mean, it could be that his dad has something similar, and it's a genetic aspect, and that's why his dad was violent and abusive.
Oh, that's a good point.
Because people can be predisposed to certain things.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. So there's lots of films, there's books, and there's YouTubes on both cases if you wanted to have a deeper dive. And again, I still don't know what the flipping spam was for. What was he going to do? Lob the blooming thing from the clock tower?
Food, maybe. If he's up there for a while, he wants a snack. If he's Marines, it might be part of their ration. If they've done any drills, he might have had that. He might like it.
Very true. And finally, the victims who should not be forgotten, but horrifically... too many to list. 62 people dead at the hands of two men.
So that is the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Murder Me Monday Podcast. Like, favorite, subscribe, leave comments, share, do some good stuff, help the algorithm. I mean, to be fair, the Patreon intro thing might be at the start of this one, so I don't need to do it now. Thankfully, that's done. I don't need to talk about smooth ball bags. And we'll see you next time. Much love, peace.
Bye.